Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast.
We have allowed ourselves to become so disconnected and ignorant about something that is as intimate as the food that we eat.
Be prepared to grow your own for victory.
God said, I need somebody strong enough to clear trees and heave bales, yet gentle enough to yean lambs and wean pigs and tend the pink-combed pullets who will stop his mower for an hour to splint the broken leg of a meadowlark. So God made a farmer.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast. I'm your host, Harold Thornbrough, and glad you're joining me today. I think we've got a great one for you. You're going to be joined by a guest, Alyssa Olson. She's going to come on and talk to us a little bit about her homestead and getting into homesteading and quite a bit about chickens. And we ain't had a chicken chat on here in a while, so Alyssa is going to give us some tips on getting started with a new flock and introducing that new flock to an existing flock and things like that. So we'll get to hear her here in a few minutes. But, you know, I haven't for a while really addressed what it is we're doing here with this podcast and website and all that we do, you know. And if you're a new listener, maybe you're thinking, what's this all about? What's this podcast really about? And, you know, we have like a mission of three things, really. We want to inspire, equip, and motivate. We want to inspire you to gain a passion for homesteading and, you know, and equip you with the information you need to start homesteading and kind of add more spokes to that homesteading wagon wheel. And also, we want to motivate you to take action on everything you hope to accomplish in your homestead. So we have we have pretty big ambitions. We just want to change the world, that's all. And we really want to help you get started down that homesteading path. I know it certainly changed my life and made my life a whole lot better, and I know it can do the same for you. So before we jump into our interview with Alyssa, let's talk about a few homestead updates here on my homestead. Seems like I'm turning my greenhouse into an animal hospital these days. At first, I had the rabbit with the ear mite issue, and I kind of separated him in the greenhouse there for a while. And then I had a quail somehow get hurt and got a damaged toe, and it was limping around. And like, when I say damaged, I mean like almost tore it off on something. I'm not real sure what happened there, but that happened a few days ago, and got him fixed up and in the greenhouse, kind of separated him because I didn't want the other quail picking at him or anything. And he's doing better. I got him in there, and he seems like he's doing all right. So I'm about ready to put him back in his cage, but I had him in the greenhouse for a few days just to kind of keep him separated. But, yeah, just turning that greenhouse into a regular old animal hospital lately. Every time I walk in there, I got animals hopping around me now. But, yeah, they're doing all right. Man, spring's coming quick, and there's a lot of cleanup to do around here. That's kind of the part I'm not looking forward to in the spring weather is all the cleanup. It's just every winter, you always look around, you're thinking, boy, look at all the dead stuff that I got to pull up, cut up, compost, you know, kind of get things organized again and get ready for the nicer weather. Also, I've been working real hard lately on content that I'm going to be adding to the membership forum. So if anybody's in there or if you're interested in joining that, there's going to be a lot of new content going up in there real soon. So I've been real working hard on that. So got a lot of stuff going on. Been real, real busy with the day job and with the stuff going around here. And in springtime, things just always pick up and get a lot busier. So with that, let's just jump right into our main topic today. We're going to have some homesteading and chicken chat with guest Alyssa Olson. Alyssa is a homesteader and blogger in Minnesota on 10 acres where she's working to expand her homestead and acquire some new homesteading skills. And we're going to discuss all kinds of stuff. We're going to talk about Alyssa's journey into homesteading, tapping birch and maple trees, her reasons for starting a blog, getting started with baby chicks, introducing young chickens to an existing flock, and her future plans on the homestead. So let's just jump right into that interview with Alyssa. Well, Alyssa, welcome to the Modern Homesteading Podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. You kind of caught my eye here recently with just all the blogging you've been doing, and you had a great blog post that that I read and I really liked. And it was about starting a backyard chicken flock and just all the the how-to on that, and thought it was really good. And you've been just popping out with all kinds of good articles here lately on chickens and fermenting and all kinds of stuff. So I wanted to have you on the podcast to maybe discuss some of that. But before we get into all that, I'd like to just hear how you got into homesteading and a little bit about you.
Well, I kind of stumbled into homesteading. My husband and I purchased a house in 2010, and we were looking for land, and it was, you know, the pit of the market. And so we found a house. It was a super old farmhouse, had a barn and everything. And we got it for a decent price on 10 acres, and we, you know, moved in. And then we had a chicken coop, so I filled it with chickens and ducks and kind of enjoyed that. And then as we grew up and we started having a family, I wanted to plant food for our family, for our kids, providing, you know, healthier, more organic food on our own and learning how to do that. And I've just kind of, you know, walked through learning and everything, and it just intrigued me. And my dad's family is actually, they're dairy farmers in Minnesota, so it's just interested me, like, how long they've living, you know, like farmers live. And my dad actually started living off the land a few years ago, and we've kind of been going on this adventure together. Different types. He's more off grid, and I'm more, you know, trying to provide our own food and stuff. But we still have a lot of similarities. So
sure.
Kind of how I got into homesteading.
You're in Minnesota as well, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, so you jumped into it pretty young, and you're consistently adding things. It sounds like. What kind of things are you doing on your homestead?
We started with chickens and ducks, and then, gardens, like vegetable gardens. We do a lot of tomatoes and cucumbers and zucchini. I've been trying my hand at, like watermelon and peppers and lettuce. And I actually got a greenhouse for Christmas this year, so I'm excited to set up a new greenhouse and see what I can grow.
Yeah.
And I've been really intrigued by how you do your, winter gardens to see if I could have green lettuce and stuff year round.
Yeah, but your winter's a whole lot more wintery than my winter.
Yeah, it is. And then preserving food, jams, jellies, and then I've been doing a lot of fermentation to try to get probiotics into my diet naturally, as well as preserving foods. And then last year I tapped birch trees for syrup. And then over the summer, I scavenged my yard for maple trees, and we actually found that we do have maple trees. So this week, we're going to start maple tree tapping.
Okay. Now, your blog is called The Sheep Shed. Do you have sheep?
Oh, yeah, we have. I forget about them. They're just like part. I lump them in with the chickens and ducks sometimes. Yeah, we have sheep. We have baby doll Southdown sheep that we got this past fall. And we plan on shearing them and using their wool for, I plan to extract lanolin from the wool in the washing process, which a lot of people don't do. And then using the wool, I plan on carding it and making roving and possibly spinning it myself and dyeing it naturally with stuff from the garden.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. You just got all kinds of things going on.
Yeah.
And you got a house full of kids, too, don't you? How many kids you have?
I have two young boys.
Yeah, I heard them when you was walking out to your car to do the podcast. I was like, wow, Erin, they're making noise in that. I thought she's got her hands full there, and you're doing all this other stuff, too. And I always try to tell people, you know, you can find the time to do this if you want to do it bad enough, you know. And a lot of people think that they can't do it because they have a family or they have a, you know, a job that requires a lot of hours. But if you want it bad enough, you find a way, don't you?
Yeah, and I enjoy it. Kind of forces me to get outside. I love being outside, but sometimes, especially like in the wintertime or when we get, you know, 5 feet of snow in the winter, it's easy to just stay inside. But you have to make an excuse to do your animals, or you have to make an excuse to go, you know, tap the maple trees, and you have to be outside even sometimes if you don't want to, but that fresh air is so good. And then if the kids come out with me, and my husband's been snowblowing paths so they can ride their bikes and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I like being outside and being, you know, away from just indoors all the time.
Sure. Now, just to back up a little bit, you said you were tapping trees. You said you tapped birch trees. Is that what you said?
Yep. Last year we tapped birch trees, and we I think we tapped too late. We didn't get much to make syrup, but we drank the, you can drink the birch sap, the birch water, plain, and it still has health benefits.
How does that compare to maple syrup and tapping maple trees?
Birch syrup is like a little, it's not something that you probably put on your pancakes.
Oh, yeah.
It's not, but it's got like a little spicier flavor. You could use it, in your, you know, to make chicken or to make, to cook with.
Yeah.
I've actually made like rhubarb syrup and lilac syrup as well for a way of preserving. And then I use those syrups too to, flavor my kombucha with.
Yeah. Okay.
So then it adds flavor, but then if there's a lot of health benefits to all that kind of stuff, lilacs, rhubarb, birch, there's health benefits to everything. And so if you can just add it in your diet in any way, it's just, it's got to be super beneficial for you.
Sure. Well, sounds great. Yeah, I've never had that. And I've heard of people tapping them. I just wondered how it compared to maple. But yeah, I didn't realize it was, so it's less sweet, but more of a spicy flavor, huh?
Yeah, and you have to have twice as much birch syrup to make, birch sap to make birch syrup.
Oh, really?
So the ratio for maple, I believe, is 40. So you need 40. This is, I'm probably going to mess it up because I just know the rate. Like, it's 40 to 1. So I think you need 40 gallons
to make
one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, 1 gallon of syrup, and then birch is 80 to 1.
Wow, that's a lot of boiling down.
Yeah.
I can see why you would just drink the sap because that would be a lot. Yeah,
yeah, you just have to drink it within a couple of days and keep it in the fridge. But it was good. And you can, it was good.
Okay. All right. Well, that was I didn't even know you were doing that. But that's interesting. You'll have to write some posts about that, I guess, if you haven't already. I didn't know.
Yeah, we're gonna get in there. Well, I'll start writing posts probably this week about the maple syrup, and then right after maple's done, then birch starts up.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that for a second. Why did you start the blog?
Because I do a lot of I think cool things. I think it's really interesting, and I post on social media about it, and I've had people my age and friends like, oh my gosh, you can do that? I did not know that you could, I didn't even know you could grow lettuce like that, or I didn't know that you could, you know, do this stuff. And it just amazes me how disconnected, like how you always talk about how disconnected we are from our food. And so I just wanted to share what I do, how to do it, kind of share experiences to hopefully inspire other people, especially younger people to just, even if you don't do it all, just do some of it.
Yeah, that's great. That's, you know, and that's kind of why I started doing it too, back and starting a podcast years ago and stuff. It was just, you know, there's so many people that just, they can do so much, even wherever they're at. I mean, you know where I'm at. I mean, a town, you know, doing it in a small backyard. You're out in the country, of course, with more acreage and doing some things. But, you know, it's amazing how disconnected we really are from, you know, the things that we could still be doing no matter where we're at. And people just don't know how to do it. And they've just lost it. You know, I mean, we've just lost a lot of those skills and those desires, even, in a lot of ways. But there's a lot of it coming back. A lot of people are waking up to it and saying, you know what, it's probably a better, healthier way to live. It's you know, it's obviously it's kind of intriguing and interesting to people. You know, they're wanting to see what they can do or how hard it is, and it's waking a lot of people up, I think. So blogs like yours and things like what we're doing are really helping people get their eyes opened up to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think people are starting to realize, I think it's intimidating, but I think that people are starting to realize that it doesn't have to be hard. It's not that hard to, you know, to just water some plants and then all of a sudden you have fruit growing off of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I know there's a lot of people that, you know, they talk about getting chickens and maybe they're a little intimidated by getting chickens, and they're just wondering, okay, what are kind of the first steps I would have to take to start a backyard chicken flock? And I ran across your article, you know, the basics of starting a backyard chicken flock, and you had some other great articles that went along with it. Can you talk about that a little bit? Can we just kind of go into that a little bit and talk about, I haven't had anybody on in a long time talking about just raising chickens. I guess it's just so, it's so out there. I mean, people are just doing it everywhere that I think we forget to talk about it, you know, but there's a lot of people that aren't doing it that really don't know where to start. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. And I think too that there's a lot of I don't necessarily try to make things pretty, because I like to make things functional. So I think there's a lot of information out there, and it sounds expensive because you have to have all this expensive stuff. And I just, mm-hmm. I like to make it simple and easy, because after all, they are livestock. I mean, I love my chickens more than probably the average chicken farmer, but they're livestock. So I don't do anything fancy. I put my chickens, I usually get chicks from, there's a local place here in Minnesota, but you can order them online or search around for farms or people who hatch chicks on their own that just, mm-hmm. you know, to have too many already. And I like to get a Rubbermaid container, put some shavings in there, food, water. And then with any animals, I like to add apple cider vinegar. It's just really mm-hmm. beneficial for their guts, for their health. And it can prevent a lot of illnesses and actually parasites as well. So I do that, and then put the... just cut a piece of chicken wire and put it over top just so that the heat lamp can rest on it. I don't really have an area in my house where I can hang a heat lamp.
Yeah, let's back up and say, how much of that apple cider vinegar do you put in their water?
They say like a teaspoon or tablespoon mm-hmm. per gallon. I usually do a little bit more, especially with the with chicks or with sick animals. I've had some sick animals or sick chickens this year, and I don't know, I just pour it over their water, right. And it gets a little, you know, a few slugs in there, and then I'm done. It's not much, but
right. Yeah, I put a like splash in like rabbit water. Yeah, I put like a splash in rabbit water bottles too, and just a little bit. I don't measure it or anything. It's probably like a tablespoon in each bottle, you know, and that's a lot less than a gallon, so it's a lot more of a ratio than that. But it doesn't seem to bother them, and I think it keeps them healthy.
Yeah, I agree.
So I'll go ahead. Yeah, the lamp, you said you put some chicken wire over the top, and you set the lamp on that? Is that what you do?
Yeah, and then a lot of heat lamps come with a guard, and mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just going to say that the guard's there for a reason, to keep you safe and the animals safe, but I find that if I take the guard off the first few weeks of the chick's life, it keeps the brooder a little bit warmer.
Mm-hmm.
I don't keep a thermometer or anything in there. You can just kind of tell how they're acting. And when the guard's on the lamp, they huddle up a lot more, and so you can tell that they're kind of cold. And when they're cold, they just don't thrive as well. So I take the guard off and use a red light and put it on the chicks for a few weeks and, you know, check their butts every single day. My 2-year-old usually helps me do that. We squat down and pick all the chicks up and check their butts for pacy butt, because mm-hmm. the pacy butt can get them really sick. Yeah. And if they have a little poop on their butt, you just, you know, rinse it off in warm water and dry them off if you need to, and just put them back in the brooder. And then, you know, just keep fresh food and water in there, keep them hot. After a couple of weeks, I put the guard back on the lamp, and I probably leave it like that the rest of the time. Sometimes you can switch to a white light because they're a little bit cooler than the red light, but... Yeah. Yeah, it just I just watch my chickens and see how they're acting. If they're acting a little bit, you know, if they're staying away from the light a lot, then you know it's a little hot in there. If they're going in the light all the time and getting out of the light, you know, mixing it up, then you know that they're doing all right.
How many do you keep in one of them tubs that size?
I've put probably like 7 chicks in there at once, and then I have multiple tubs. So I always like to have at least 2, because if you do have a sick chicken or a sick chick, you want to separate it out just in case it's contagious. And then also, even if it's not contagious, chickens are kind of mean in the way that they sense a weak bird and they will just attack them. It.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so yeah, you separate it out. And then once they start getting a little bit bigger and start getting more feathers, then you'll want to separate them out. I think last year... I had, at the end of the year, I had 2 brooders with probably 3 chicks in each one, and it was pretty full before I put them in the coop.
Mm.
So I always start with 1 and then add them in as I need to. By the time you're adding them in and the chicks are getting big, then you probably don't need a light anymore. It's usually about like 8 weeks that they start really growing.
Yeah.
I find, and then at that time too, being in Minnesota, I like to get bigger breeds mm-hmm. just because I've had smaller breeds and they just don't do well in the winter time here. I don't heat my coop.
And
so.
these are laying chickens. These aren't meat chickens, right?
Right. Yeah. No, meat chickens at 8 weeks, you'll have a full grown.
Yeah, I was gonna say, because at 8 weeks with the corners crossed, you're pretty close to processing.
Yeah. No. At 8 weeks, I would say the birds. There's, you can still fit them in your palm. They're still pretty small. Yeah.
Okay.
The chickens don't really get full size till even close to a year. I want to say they take a little while.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, well, so you know, how, you know, you're just watching them when they have all their feathers and all the down is covered up, and that's when you're pretty much going to move them outside then?
Well, yeah, it depends on the weather here. So with the chicks, you know, around 10 weeks, I'll start putting the brooders, depending on how warm it is, sometimes a little earlier, but I'll put the brooders outside, leave the chickens in the brooders and put them outside in a spot I know is sunny. Yeah. During the day, and then I'll bring them in at night and put the lamp back on them and kind of do that. It kind of gets them used to the fresh air and the wind.
It's almost like hardening off transplants. You need your guard. You got to get them ready for it, right?
Yep, and then I work up to around 10 weeks. I'll let them free range, usually by themselves, away from the big chickens. Let them free range so they kind of learn how to, you know, go for bugs, and then they kind of find shelter in, you know, my plants and stuff, and they figure it out. And I watch them because we do have hawks and stuff. So, but I'll let them do that as long as I'm out in the garden, and then again, bring them in and put them under the light if they still need it. And then probably 11 weeks, I'll start free ranging them with the big birds. Not necessarily, they don't usually intermingle as much. The big birds might come check them out. And if I don't let them establish pecking order, but just get used to each other.
Yeah.
And then after that, after like a week or so of that, then I put the brooders in the coop, covered still, so that they're used to where their home is. The big birds know that, you know, these guys are going to be here. And then after a couple days of that, not very long, then I take the lids off and let them go in and out. So they have shelter if they want. The big birds can't attack them.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the day when the big birds are free ranging, I lock the babies in the run, so that they're used to their home, and then, you know, that they can be separate from each other. And then at night they all roost up together.
Yeah. Okay. So you say now you keep them from establishing a pecking order. How do you do that exactly? You just get on them when they start after each other, or what are you doing?
Yeah. Your older chickens, you're kind of like the alpha rooster. So as soon as you start kind of pushing them away, they'll start to realize, you know, that you're going to protect them, or that they're your birds, so that if they mess with them, they're going to get you. So, yeah, I just watch them and shoo them away. And they're, you know, they're usually happy to be free ranging, so they're going to go find some bugs.
Right. Now, do you keep roosters as well?
This is the first year I've had roosters. The first few roosters I had were really mean. They were very mean, and I would go outside of my car and they would come attack me. So we didn't do well with those. And then this year I had a rooster that I fell in love with as a chick, because he got, well, I didn't know it was a rooster. I fell in love with this chick that got sick and kind of nursed it back to health. And then as he matured, I saw that he was a rooster. And so I made sure to always hold him and always, you know, make sure that he knew that I was going to take care of him, but then he needs to be nice to me.
Yeah.
And so he actually is a very nice rooster. And then I had two more roosters out of chicks. And I didn't have to do anything with them. So I don't know if they just saw that he was nice to me and he was the alpha rooster, so they just respected me. But yeah, I have three roosters, and then I just rehomed a fourth rooster right now. So really? I have four roosters.
Okay. Well, those others just heard about old Soup and Stewie that were attacking you and what happened to them, so they didn't want to mess with that. So they better be nice.
Yeah.
Well, okay. That's what I was wondering, is how the roosters would do with the, when you're bringing out the new flock. I mean, they just taking them in? It's just like the chickens? Are they just taking a little while to adapt and then they're fine? Or do you have any of them going after the new flock?
They are a little bit harder. When I do introduce, when I introduced babies to the flock, I have a lot of roosting bars in my coop. I have a really, it's an old farmhouse, so I have a small coop, but I made like a ladder, so it has a bunch of roosting bars, and then I have nesting boxes with roosting bars, and we have a rafters that the chickens roost on. So I usually put the babies like on the ladder, So they're away from all the other birds, and they kind of learn that that's where their safe haven is. So if they start getting bothered, they climb up there, and the roosters, I've never seen the roosters go up there.
Yeah. So the key really is just a lot of hands-on, just watching them and just keeping things kind of, you know, kind of
in order.
Yeah,
and I've never had a rooster kill a bird before. I've had my ducks last year did. So
really?
When I do, that's another thing, is I have ducks in my coop too, two Pekin ducks, and mm-hmm. I have a kiddie pool in the run. So when I introduce babies to the flock, I dump the kiddie pool out because that's how I lost the bird last year. She was probably drinking from the water, and the duck just pushed her in, and chickens can't swim. So I learned my lesson that way. Now I just flip the kiddie pool over for a few weeks until they start figuring out their way in the coop.
Right. Wow. Okay. So you do mix them together then, so you don't have any other troubles with that, having them together like that?
I've never had any issues with the ducks. I've always housed ducks and chickens together. I know some people are against it, but mm-hmm. I keep in the summertime all the water in the run so the coop stays dry. Mm-hmm. And then in the wintertime, I have buckets in the coop, and I find that the ducks, because they're always drinking, that they actually, I don't even heat the chicken water. The ducks are constantly drinking, so they're keeping it from freezing on the top.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, just keeping that water moving, yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so, I mean, you get them adapted in, and then you just... How do you determine when it's time to retire the old flock? I mean, you're just watching for them to stop laying or slowing down their laying and just kind of going that route, or constantly introducing new ones like that? Or
We actually, our chickens, since we don't heat our coop in the wintertime, mm-hmm. we usually don't get eggs in the wintertime.
Yeah.
Sometimes we'll get some here and there, and a lot of times they're frozen, so you have to throw them anyway. But since we don't heat our coop, we've had chickens lay daily from spring to fall for 5 years.
Okay.
And so they end up dying before they stop, laying.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
they don't have a super long lifespan, and chickens are allotted, you know, X amount of eggs per lifetime. So as long as you're not forcing them to lay all the time, they can lay for quite a few years.
Yeah. Yeah. So you said something there, you don't heat your coop, and you're in Minnesota, and I have people all the time asking me that, you know, what do I need to do to heat my coop? But I mean, you're about where it's as cold as it gets, and you're not heating it. And do you have any problems with that?
Like I said, with the smaller birds, or one year I had a frizzle chicken, which all their feathers are flipped upside down. So she was a really cute, pretty bird. I didn't really think about that she couldn't probably hold in heat. So I've had issues with that. And so I've kind of bought chickens. I always make sure they're hardy. I don't buy bantams or anything. But other than that, no, I've never had issues this year because of the cold, the polar vortex that we had. It got super cold, and a lot of the tips of the rooster's combs got frozen, mm-hmm. and they'll probably fall off. But other than that, like, I've never had any super huge issues. I usually block off the run with a wood board so that there's no draft there.
Sure.
And then you just want to make sure it's ventilated. We didn't build our coop, so I don't know, you know, I don't know the logistics of it. It's, our coop is, you know, probably close to 100 years old. So it's a little bit drafty, more than, you know, a new one would be, but I've never had any issues. They just need to be protected from the wind mostly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of, you know, that's always been my thing. I've always said too, you know, as long as there isn't wind directly blowing on them, and you know, there's some good ventilation in there, then they should be fine, you know. And mm-hmm. People are always a little bit shocked at that. They just really think that they need heat. And you know, I have quail and rabbits, and I don't heat where they're at either.
Yeah.
And they do just perfect through the winter. Of course, again, my winters aren't quite like your winters, but we're in Indiana, so it's pretty cold here. And you know,
yeah.
I don't ever have any issues even with those livestock. So yeah, I just it's something that I think that the if you've got the right setup, you don't need to bring in what I call a fire risk, because when you're heating a coop, there's been a lot of coops burned down trying to heat them.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that, and if your lamp goes out, because you're not, your birds are used to hot climate, so when mm-hmm. the lamp goes out, I've heard that you can get them all sick, and I don't really want to deal with that either.
Right.
I don't want to deal with the burnt down coop
or
sick chicks.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. Well, it sounds like you've got it pretty well figured out as far as just introducing new birds to your flock and how you're doing things there. How many birds did you say you had?
We have 4 roosters and 8 hens.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have 4 baby chicks this year. So we're kind of slowing down buying. I think we're going to be done buying, and hopefully we'll start hatching next year when we need to replace old ones.
We can't leave those two ducks out. We got a couple ducks there too, right?
Oh, yeah, 2 ducks too.
How many sheep do you have?
4.
4? Okay. So
yep,
you got
a ram and a wether.
Okay. You got a decent amount of animals there to take care of, and you have, what, 10 acres, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, 10 acres. So, yeah, okay. So, you got all kinds of room for garden and orchard and all kinds of things. What do you have going on out through there? You said you got a decent-sized garden? Or?
Yeah, I've been kind of slacking on the garden with the young kids when I was pregnant. It was really hard for me to be out in the heat. And then with a newborn and stuff, it's hard for them to be out in the heat with
right,
me.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Last year was my first year really back in the garden again, which was nice. And then this year, I'm hoping to take a few acres, probably about an acre of land, and clear it off. I want to do like a lavender patch, a strawberry patch.
That's a big garden.
I want to do more medicinal herbal type things, and then also do like fruit. I want to do blueberries, strawberries, and raspberries too, because my kids will probably eat more than I do.
Those won't even make it in the house. They'll be out there.
No, they don't. They come out there with the garden meat with me, and they just go right to the tomatoes and the fruit. So
that's how my grandson was last year. He was in the strawberry patch eating them quicker than I could pick them.
Yeah, and that's all right.
Yeah, that's what I think too. Now, so a lot of your property wooded then?
Nope, we're actually really sandy. So we have the whole back part of my yard is evergreens, and then we have a lot of ash and oak, but we have a swamp at the back end of our property, and that's where our birch and maple are, so I have to walk a ways to go tap. And
that's
then
what I was
the
wondering
just,
where you were tapping at, if you didn't have a lot of wooded lot. I was curious.
Yeah, it's kind of far away, but it'll be all right. We have it's a lot of sand and hills and stuff, so
yeah. Okay, so you got what's your future ambitions for your property? What are you planning on doing besides your herb garden, growing a lot more herbs and things? What else you got on the agenda?
I'm gonna try to take it a little like year by year. So this year I really want to focus on the gardens, get the greenhouse going. You know, do the garden plots in the side of the house, and then I eventually would like to get bees. I really am interested in getting bees and honey and beeswax and all the things you can do with that. And just really learning. I've learned how to forage some, you know, you just walk around my property and there's so many flowers. There's so many greens that you can just pick and dry and you can make tea out of, or you can make like tinctures and stuff. So I've been really interested in doing some of that stuff too.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So
thinking about planting more trees or anything like that? You thinking about planting more trees, like some fruit trees or anything? Or?
Yep. I ordered 35 birch trees to plant. And then I was trying to grow, you know, some fruit trees on my own, but I think that I'm better off buying. But I'll probably purchase, a few fruit trees throughout the years, and then cranberry bushes and elderberry bushes.
When you say starting on your own, you mean starting from seed? Is that what you were trying to do?
Yeah,
Yeah, that's difficult.
What was that?
I said, yeah, that can be pretty difficult with the stratification and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll probably keep trying to see if I can get it down, but fruit trees take a while to bear fruit, so I might end up buying some started trees and then practice my talents later.
How long does it take those birch trees before they're ready to tap? It's probably a while too.
I think probably 5 to 10 years.
Oh, there, really?
I'm buying. Our Minnesota does conservation district, so each county you can buy, you know, 2-foot trees that are local to your area, for $1 a tree.
Oh yeah.
And that's where I got my birch trees from. So they're going to be really small. They're not going to be any kind of size. So they'll take a while.
Well, you can't beat that price, though, I imagine. So, yeah,
no,
that's a pretty good deal.
That's, yeah, and maybe they won't even all take, but it doesn't hurt trying. It doesn't hurt putting them in the dirt and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, sounds like you got some big plans for your place there, and you'll be give you plenty to be blogging about over the next few years, it sounds like. And you're just acquiring so many great skills. It sounds like you're really, you know, you're really focused on just skill building too, just the things you're doing in your kitchen, things you're, you know, with the fermenting, and we didn't really even get into that yet. I mean, you're making kombucha, fermented lemonade and some other fermented things. So you're doing a lot of fermenting too. You've been writing a lot of blog posts about that. So those are just great skills to have, you know, and just, you know, like you've even been mentioning on your blog, you know, just a lot of, you know, it, really focusing on the gut health and that stuff. It's just, it's really, really good for that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to have, I think that we lose a lot of nutrition in things that we buy, even if you buy fermented food. Or I was blown away. What got me into fermenting was when I was making pickles this past year, that pickles aren't even fermented anymore. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Dug down a huge rabbit hole of fermented pickles, and then I discovered this whole world of fermented food. And I had actually been doing kombucha, which I knew it was fermenting and stuff, and but yeah, I didn't realize everything that you could ferment. And so it's really intrigued me and really interests me on how many health benefits come along with that.
Yeah, and you're right, we have gotten away from that. Now it's all just a quick process and get it out there and make it taste good, and we just ignore the actual health benefits of our food. It's just all about taste anymore, and just trying to get, you know, it's trying to get a palatable product in front of you rather than a healthy product sometimes.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, well, it sounds like you're doing a lot of great stuff there, and you know, we're just, I'm really looking forward to reading more about all the stuff you're doing, and you know, I'm sure the listeners would be too. So let's point them to your blog. Where are you sharing this stuff at?
My blog is thesheepshedmn.com, and I have a website and a blog, so it has information about my farm, and then I have my blog post on there, and then I also have a Facebook page, which is thesheepshedmn.
Okay. We'll definitely point people towards all those articles. Like I said, you've been writing some great stuff. I've been really enjoying reading it. And you're also part of the Homestead Forum membership community. Hopefully some folks can pop in there and talk to you too if they have any questions or want to know more about what you're doing.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely link this up in there as well so they can hit you up if they have any questions about the stuff you're doing. But it sounds like you got a lot of great plans, and I'm just really glad you came on to talk to me about them today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, that was a great interview with Alyssa. So much good information there. I definitely want you to go check out her blog. She's been working hard on that blog, let me tell you, writing all kinds of great articles and stuff. And they're so good, and there's so many of them that it definitely caught my eye. So definitely want to go check that out at thesheepshedmn.com. There'll be a link in the show notes for you if you want to go there to connect with Alyssa on her blog. And this is episode 117. So the show notes for this episode, of course, can be found at smalltownhomestead.com/117. So you can just go there to check out the show notes. So let's just jump right into our homestead recipe of the week. Today we have one called in from Dusty. Dusty called this in from his car on his long commute to and from work. So there's a little bit of background noise, but it's a great recipe for pan-smoked salmon. And if you're listening to this and you haven't had lunch or dinner yet, you're going to get really, really hungry. So I apologize because this sounds really good. But take it away, Dusty.
Hi, this is Dusty from New Beginnings Farm on Maryland's Eastern Shore. Unfortunately, I have a 2.5-hour commute home. I work outside of Washington, D.C. and live about 100 miles from work. The one recipe that my family loves is smoking a piece of salmon on your stovetop. The equipment you'll need, of course, is we use an electric stove. If you use a gas stove, you might have to watch the flame. A stainless steel pan that you're no longer going to use for anything else but something like this. We have an old one that the handle fell off, and some aluminum foil. Your ingredients are a fillet or two of salmon with the skin on, fresh ginger root, scallions, teriyaki, the sauce, not the marinade, or you can use soy, whole coriander, bay leaves, and that's it. So what you do, you take the aluminum foil and you make it into bowls. Usually I make about 4 bowls to fit in my 16-inch stainless steel pan. Then I will take the fillet and I always wash it off, even though it's been sitting at the seafood market or at the grocery store in the ice. I still check to make sure if it has scales on, scale it. Then I will cut the salmon fillets big enough to fit inside the bowl. In each bowl will be a salmon fillet, a splash of the teriyaki or soy, whatever you use on the fillet, sliced scallions, and then I'll grate some pressed ginger on top. Inside the old pan, I put whole bay leaves, about five or six, whole coriander, just dump some in, and then I coat the bottom with some more slices of scallion. I'll turn the pan on until you start seeing the scallion and bay leaves smoking, which is usually medium-high. Once it starts smoking, cut it back to medium-low, and then you place the salmon bowls in the foil on top of the smoking bay leaves, coriander, and scallions. Then I cover the whole pan with another sheet of aluminum foil and slightly leave one end open to allow smoke to escape. And on medium low, sorry, that was a bump, you just let it smoke for about 10, maybe 12 minutes. Open up the outer layer of aluminum foil, and if you see the white fat, and of course the salmon turns from a bright pink to a dull pink, depending on how rare or how fully cooked you want, the salmon will be done. And that's our favorite family recipe.
Oh, that sounds like a really good recipe. I'm definitely going to have to try that one because I like salmon, so that sounds like I'd be right up my alley. If you want to send in your favorite homestead recipe, and we do need more, I have one more for the next episode, and then I don't have any after that, so I definitely need you folks to send in some more great recipes. I know you have them. Don't be shy. Send them in. But if you want to send in an audio recording of some of your favorite homestead recipes, I'd love to add one to the podcast each week. Here's how you might do that. Most cell phones usually have a recording app installed that you could use, and just hit the button, start talking, say this is so-and-so from, if you have a website or a Facebook page or a homestead name, throw that in there. If not, you don't have to, and just say a recipe I like and want to share with you today is, and just give us the recipe, and just try to keep that recording between 1 and 5 minutes. You don't have to go into great detail, but we'd love to listen to it and then know how to do it ourselves. It doesn't have to be perfect. When you're done recording and satisfied with how it sounds, just email it to me at sthomestead@gmail.com and I'll add it to a future episode. And again, if you have a website or a Facebook page or a homestead that you want to promote with a link, I'll add that link into the show notes. Just give it to me with your email and I'll add it to the show notes. But that's all there is to it. We're looking forward to getting lots of great recipes in so I can add them to the podcast episode. Let's jump into this week's listener question. Well, before we do that, though, I had an email about last week's listener question where we talked about composting in the wintertime. And I got this email from Rosie in the UK, and she had some great suggestions on what she does with her food scraps in the wintertime before they go to the compost. And her email says, "Hello, Harold. I listened to your last podcast about heating your home with wood burning and enjoy it. We have a wood burning stove and I found the advice helpful. The listener question about composting in winter made me think about what I do to reduce the amount of stuff I'm taking outside in inclement weather. I put all my veg peelings, onion skins, herb trimmings, etc., in a big bag in the freezer. When it's full and the weather is better, I throw it in a big pot with boiling water and a little salt and cook it up as stock for an hour or so. I then freeze the stock and the peelings can go in my worm composter and tends to get broken down more quickly by the worms when it's cooked." And she went on to say some other things, some suggestions for some future podcast episodes and such. But I thought that was really good advice. It's something that we do around here. I don't save up too many at a time because I'll usually throw those vegetables in with some, maybe a chicken carcass or something like that and make a broth with it, make a vegetable and chicken broth together. Or stock. And but that's great advice, especially in the wintertime. You could save that up for several weeks, and when it's really, really bad outside, you wouldn't have to take it to the compost pile. So that's a great piece of advice. And I agree, it would break down a lot quicker being softened up, by the boiling water after it's been cooked. so it would break down a lot quicker in a regular compost pile or a vermicompost pile. So great stuff, Rosie. Thank you for that. And thank you for listening way over there in the UK. Appreciate that. I love getting emails from other parts of the world. It's always encouraging. But this week's question comes in from Stephanie. She says, "Hi, Harold. I love your podcast. I'm starting my first garden this year, mostly due to your video of your backyard." Just to break away from the question for a minute here, I had posted a video of a little tour of our homestead like almost a year ago. It was late spring last year. Kind of walked around and just showed some of the things we were doing. It's on YouTube, so you can go to our YouTube channel and find that. And she goes on to say, "I didn't realize what was possible until I watched your video. My yard is the same size. Thanks so much for the video. It totally opened my eyes to the possibilities. My question is about the Dirty Dozen. I have watched videos from Don Tolman and his Kabbalah Juice. He says that apples and most fruits are okay even if they are not organic, if they are washed in an apple cider vinegar and water solution prior to using them. From what I understand, the skin of the apple is a barrier and keeps out pesticides. Just wondering if this is accurate. By the way, you should try his Kabbalah Juice recipe. It's amazing. It's almost like an energy drink, but all natural and delicious. Thanks so much for your time and effort in the podcast and videos." Well, thanks, Stephanie, for the question. I've never heard of Don Tolman or Kabbalah Juice, but it sounds good. It really does. And I believe you. I have a Ninja that I make drinks with, and I think it works really good. And I'll do that. I'll throw, a bunch of vegetables in it and maybe a little juice and mix up a little drink, and it does good. So I believe it probably is really, really good. And I make that quite a bit. As far as the Dirty Dozen, now, if people don't know, the Dirty Dozen are a list of fruits and vegetables that if you're going to buy non-organic produce, that you should at least buy these vegetables and fruits in the organic form, because they tend to have more pesticide residue and bad stuff just attached to them when they're conventional fruits and vegetables rather than organic. Now, the issue here is that Don Tolman, and like I said, I'm not really familiar with him. I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, has said that apples and a lot of vegetables and fruits are fine if they're just washed. And I'll just go ahead and tell you that apples in 2018 made the Dirty Dozen list. And there was some controversy over that, because what mostly makes the Dirty Dozen list of those fruits and vegetables are porous skinned vegetables, things that easily absorb pesticides. Well, apples, as you've pointed out, is a kind of a slick skinned, thicker skinned fruit that doesn't tend to absorb things, or it seemingly wouldn't absorb things like some other things like strawberries. Strawberries are notorious for it, and they're laid on pretty heavy with pesticides. So they're really one that they advise to either grow yourself or buy in the organic form. But apples, there is some controversy about that. The apple producing industry kind of came back against that Dirty Dozen list and pretty hard. And they said, look, we've had these studies done and there's very little residue getting into the apple. Now, it is on the skin of the apple, because the reason it made the list is because it is something they lay the pesticides on really, really heavy on those apples. But as you've pointed out, or as this Don Tolman has pointed out, that you can just wash a lot of that residue off with water and an apple cider vinegar mix. Now, I don't know. I'm not a scientist, of course, but it does make sense to me that you would be able to wash a lot of that off. And like I said, it's not a porous skin, so it does seem like it wouldn't absorb as much of the pesticides as some other things. And so obviously washing your fruits and vegetables, no matter in what form they're coming in, is a good idea. And porous skin fruits and vegetables are going to absorb much more of the harmful chemicals. I have no doubts about that. But here's the thing. I'm always going to kind of lean towards the safer side of things, or if there's any doubt in my mind at all, I'm going to lean towards organic or growing it myself. Just because of my past, I've had cancer and I've been kind of, I'm on high alert for things like pesticides and stuff. So I want as little of that in my body as I can get. And if there's a chance, if it's made the Dirty Dozen list, I'm probably going to lean away from it. on the conventional side of things. But now that being said, I believe what he's saying is probably true. I think you could probably get most of it off of there by washing it. And what's left probably wouldn't be that harmful in small amounts. So, yeah, I'm going to say that he's probably right. He's probably done a lot more research into that. But definitely, as far as that dirty dozen list, there are certain things. Look at the list. Anybody that's wanting to see the list, you can just type up the dirty dozen list of fruits and vegetables on Google or whatever, and you'll bring that right up. And it'll tell you, you get two lists. You'll get the list of the dirty dozen, and you'll get the clean dozen, generally, on those lists. And those clean dozen are things that, you know, that you can say, hey, I feel pretty good about buying these things in the conventional form. Because the reality is organic fruits and vegetables are much more expensive than the conventionally produced fruits and vegetables. So you can save some money by buying those clean ones. So that's my thoughts on it. I say he probably knows more about it than me. He probably is right that you can wash most of that off and make it pretty safe to make your drinks out of. So, you know, take his advice over mine. But if you're like me and you're always wanting to lean on the safe side of things, I'm pretty big about you definitely washing my fruits and vegetables that I'm buying and soaking those things in water for a while before I, prepare them for a meal, and growing the things that I'm eating a lot of, I try to grow myself. So that's just kind of where I lean on it. But those are my thoughts. And thank you so much for the email and the suggestion to take out to check out the Kabbalah juice recipe. I'll definitely check it out. It sounds really good. And for watching the video and being inspired to get started growing your own garden. I think that's great. It makes me feel good that what I said and what I showed you in that video is helping you to make the decision to kind of get started going down that path yourself. So thanks for the question and the comments. If you want to submit a question for the podcast, you can send your questions to ask@smalltownhomestead.com. Love to have your questions. I definitely want to start answering one a week on the podcast. I keep doing that. Not going into a lot of detail on them, but I can do the quick answers. And so I really appreciate you sending those in. This podcast is made possible by those who join our Homestead Forum membership community. To learn more about the benefits of membership, you can just click on Become a Member at smalltownhomestead.com. I also appreciate those who shop through our Amazon affiliate link. That's always a great way to support this podcast and the things that we're doing. And we really appreciate those who share this podcast with others and leave us reviews and stuff at iTunes and other places. And of course, always thankful for the companies and individuals who have partnered with us for advertising, sponsorship, and support through our membership. Really appreciate that. It's what makes things great about that membership, especially. We have a lot of folks that offer discounts to our members, to our membership. So we really appreciate those companies that do that. The show notes, again, for this episode can be found at smalltownhomestead.com/117. And I'll just leave you with this quote from Alfred Austin. He says, "The glory of gardening, hands in the dirt, head in the sun, heart with nature. To nurture a garden is to feed not just the body, but the soul." I agree with that 100%. Thanks for joining me today, folks. Happy homesteading, and God bless.
Thanks for listening. To see the show notes for this podcast or listen to other podcast episodes, go to smalltownhomestead.com. There you can also read our blog, connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, and take advantage of the many resources we make available to help you along in your homesteading journey. Please share this podcast and help us to carry out our mission of helping others to homestead today for a better tomorrow.